Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. For those of you who've just joined us, we have a lot of good information to share with you today on topics that are generally not given a lot of attention. In fact, I try to select the issues that impact upon everyone, even though they may not be popular topics. For example, one of the topics that almost gets no attention is the effect of low-level radiation. Now, I'm quite sure that if you went to your public health official, your legislator, your physician and said, "What is low-level radiation? Am I exposed to it? Will it hurt me?" I'm quite sure that that individual would say, "Well, low-level radiation is just some background radiation. Really has no significant impact upon our well-being. Not to worry." And you would say, "Okay, thank you." What if I told you that between 6 and 9 million Americans have died due to the effects of low-level radiation upon their immune systems during the past 50 years, and that there is really supporting strong evidence for this, but the powers that be have not wanted to admit this because, first, it would show failed public policy, and secondly, it would really make them responsible financially for paying these people for damages. We're going to explore that in today's program in depth. Also, alternative approaches to treating pain, all forms of pain. So you're going to learn the neurotherapies, the bee venom, body talk, psychokinesiology, nutritional, biochemical, hormonal evaluation, trigger point, prolotherapy, reconstructive therapy, everything about pain. Before we go to those two subjects, let me give you some of the latest in health and nutrition update. Recently, I was challenged on the subject of artificial sweeteners. One of the people in this audience said that because they were a diabetic and had for the past 20 years been using artificial sweeteners, including saccharin, cyclamates, now aspartame, that they were concerned over a statement that I had made that it posed side effects and risks. When this person went to the scientific literature and contacted government agencies, they were told that there is no evidence that it is harmful, that the studies show that it is fine. So therefore, the person wrote me a rather critical letter, and I would like to respond to that. The problem when you, as a lay person, accept what the special interest groups tell you is you're assuming that they are accurate and have nothing but the truth to offer you. I sent this person the following studies. 166 studies have been done on the safety, human safety, of aspartame. 74 of these studies were actually paid for by NutraSweet industry-related funding. So therefore, the manufacturer paid for the studies. Therefore, it controlled the design of the studies, what was studied, how long it went, and who could then interpret the results. None of that is peer-reviewed. Now, 100% of their studies show that there was no problem. That's what this man found. What he did not find, what he did not know existed, or did not look for, were the studies, 92 studies on aspartame that were independently funded by agencies or organizations that had nothing to do with the outcome financially. Completely objective. Of the 92 studies that were done independently, 92% of them found problems with aspartame. So all you have to do is look to this idea of who's paying for the studies. And then you'll see why the people who are paying for them almost never find anything wrong with their research. But when their research methods have been studied, they've been flawed. The research design's flawed. And then what about the studies that this person wasn't told? If you contact the FDA and ask them, what studies do you have that show that aspartame is bad? They're not going to tell you any. They're only going to give you the NutraSweet aspartame industry funded studies. And they'll say they're all right. They've intentionally excluded the 92 studies that show there are problems with aspartame. So the studies are there. Do your homework. Be more diligent, less critical. And remember, you've chosen, and here's what we have to appreciate, you've chosen not to change your diet, not to exercise, not to de-stress, and to stick within, is, in according to the conversation I had with you, your comfort zone. Why don't you take a look at all the individuals who had type 2 diabetes who did the changes and today have no diabetes? Their blood sugar is normalized without insulin or medications. They're happier, healthier, more vital. That's a choice too. But I'm quite sure that if you want to find people who would say that you can't change type 2 diabetes, you'll find them. But what you won't find are the people who you're not looking for. What you don't want to find, you will not look in that direction. For those who believe that Monsanto, including an attorney who sent me an email talking about why would I challenge Monsanto when all the good they've done, I haven't seen the good that Monsanto's done. If you have the good that Monsanto's done, please share it with me and I'll be happy to share it with this audience. I have seen where this multinational, transnational, giant company has identified a new business opportunity because of the emerging water crisis and the funding through the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to exploit people. Now, in its own words, in its own strategy paper, it says first, quote, we believe that discontinuities, either major policy changes or major trend line breaks in resource quality and quantity are likely, particularly in the area of water, and we will be well positioned vis-a-vis these business, meaning owned by Monsanto, mentioned just a moment ago, to profit even more significantly when these discontinuities occur. Second, we are exploring the potential of non-conventional financing, NGOs, World Bank, USDA, etc., that may lower our investment or provide local country business building resources. Unquote. What that means is this. The crisis worldwide of pollution and depletion of water resources is viewed by Monsanto as a great business opportunity. For Monsanto, their, quote, sustainable development, unquote, means the conversion of an ecological crisis into a market of scarce resources. They've done it in India. What they're doing is they're going into countries, starting with India, and they are buying up water rights. And because governments are so hard-pressed for currency, and because they're also frequently very corrupt, they will sell these water rights to a company like Monsanto. Monsanto then goes in and then starts charging people, including poor farmers, for water. Without water, you can't grow anything. But that's not Monsanto's interest. Monsanto knows that at some point, world pressure can be brought to bear to cause world funding. After all, the right spin with the right Bernstein advertising agency and some of the others that represent the multinational interest, you could show poor kids, thirsty kids. You could have one of these infomercial celebrities who can't get a job anymore, who will shill for anyone, getting out there and saying, look at these poor kids. They don't even have water to drink, but they could. They just can't afford it. Water is so expensive, you won't see Monsanto's name behind it. And we have to help these people be able to have drinkable water. Now there is a source, there's a solution, clean water. All they need is your help. And Americans will think, well, yeah, that's a good cause. Legislators will think it's a good cause. It's not a good cause. It does not help the people. It just means that Monsanto, one of the most ruthless, immoral companies in the world, run by equally ruthless, immoral, amoral individuals, because corporations do not create policy without people. They are now looking to take third world exploitation even to another level, but this time involved first world funding. Good business? You bet. Good ethics? It sucks. But then again, everything Monsanto does sucks. And to the lawyer who wrote me the letter, I don't blame you for not having any intellect by being a lawyer, but by God, in the future, do your homework. I'm sick and tired of people making criticisms who are so incapable of doing definitive research before you talk on something out of complete ignorance. Monsanto is utterly disgusting at every level and has done nothing to help the world except to exploit it. And I'll do about a three-hour show just on Monsanto alone. Let's go over and say hello to our first guest. My first guest is Dr. Ernest Sternglass. Dr. Sternglass has spent a lot of time in his career in nuclear physics and down in, I believe, the University of, is it the University of Pittsburgh you've been at?
Pittsburgh School of Medicine.
Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Of trying to help people be aware that there's a difference between what radiation you get from a chest x-ray, from a nuclear bomb exposure, from a power plant, and from all the other ways that we can be exposed to both ionizing and low-level radiation. So we're going to go into that in some depth. Nice to have you with us again today, Dr. Sternglass.
Thank you.
Dr. Sternglass, briefly summarize the principles of your group study where you were looking at, of all things, baby teeth, and it was called the Tooth Fairy Project.
That's right. Actually, the history of it goes back to the bomb test years in 1958, 60, Barry Commoner in St. Louis and his group for nuclear information had the made the decision to gather baby teeth and measure the amount of fission products, strontium-90, which is produced when a bomb, when uranium fissions or plutonium fissions, and it gets into the bone of the mother and, it, you know, through the diet, what she drinks and eats, and then also to the developing baby in the mother's womb. And they did find a very sharp rise of strontium-90 in the teeth and jaw bones of babies. And it rose to a peak in about 1962, 63, which is the time when there was just a year or so after the end of bomb testing in 1963, which Kennedy negotiated with Khrushchev. And then it plunged again. And at the time, nobody suspected that one could easily detect the effect on human health. But since then, it's been found that all over the world, in England, in Denmark, in the U.S., in Japan, all over the world, there was a startling rise in childhood leukemia and cancer that accompanied the increase in strontium-90 in human bone. And so this information was fed to the science advisors of the president, Kennedy at the time, and he, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, wanted to end bomb testing. But the military wouldn't agree to a total test ban, so he managed to negotiate a treaty with Russia, with Khrushchev, to end at least bomb testing in the atmosphere. And that was a very big decision. And I'm glad that at the time, because we were concerned about building fallout shelters at the time when we were building a new home, I looked into it and I wrote an article for Science about the fact that very small amounts of radiation, just the one or two x-rays, during the late part of pregnancy, were found by Dr. Alice Stewart in Oxford to have doubled the risk of childhood leukemia and cancer. And the bombs that the Russians exploded in 1961 and 62, breaking the moratorium on testing, produced the equivalent of an abdominal x-ray to every person, including every pregnant woman in the Northern Hemisphere. And so I finally got this article published, and fortunately, with the help of people like Barry Commoner, and that was used by President Kennedy to say that at least we can stop the atmospheric tests, ending strontium 90 in the bone of our children, and ending the rise in cancers that is bound to happen. Now we know he was right, and the fact that this happened is probably the fact that he was able to get the treaty ratified. He held hearings, and a number of scientists, including myself, came to testify about the importance of ending bomb testing based on the rise of strontium 90 in baby teeth.
Dr. Sternglass, could you explain why even small levels of strontium 90 in baby teeth are of such serious concern?
Well, what happens is that the strontium 90 is like calcium, which we all know we need, and it goes to the bones of the mother and the developing baby, and it emits a small particle called an electron or beta ray that travels just a tenth of an inch, and it gets into the bone marrow, where all the cells of the bone marrow that are protective, the white cells of the body, the policemen of the body, are formed. And therefore, the biggest effect that was finally established in animal experiments in 1968 at the Oslo Cancer Hospital by Stocky and Osterdahl, they found that just a tiny amount of radiation, 10-15%, of what we get from natural background radiation was enough to make a very noticeable decline in the number of cells in the bone marrow. And so you can see that this would have an important effect on all types of immune system diseases, the ability to fight infections, and the ability to fight cancer. But that's not all. Unfortunately, the strontium 90, when it emits the beta ray, turns into another element called yttrium 90. And this also emits a powerful million-volt electron, and it goes to the pituitary glands, to the soft tissue glands that produce the hormones in the developing baby and cause damage that will affect the whole future of the life of the child. And therefore, strontium 90 has always been regarded as the most toxic of all the products that are created in fission in general.
What other... Well, let's step back for a moment. How can you be sure, or at least so sure, that these low levels of strontium 90 have been responsible for the recent rise in newly reported childhood leukemia and other cancers in Westchester County in New York and other areas of the country, when there are so many other environmental pollutants like PCBs, pesticides, herbicides, cigarette smoke, diesel exhaust, and other chemicals in the environment as well?
Well, that's why we have done this collection of teeth in areas both near and distant from nuclear reactors. And what we find is that the largest amounts of strontium 90 today in baby teeth that shouldn't be there anymore have actually risen since the early 1980s in Westchester and Long Island and New Jersey and Florida and Dade County, Miami, and even in places like San Luis Obispo in California, where there's the Rancho Seco nuclear reactor. And in all the cases, it's impossible to account for a rise in this short-lived strontium 90, which only has a half-life of some 28 years, and in fact gets eliminated from the bone of children in a matter of 2 or 3 years by half. There shouldn't be any left. And in fact, we find levels in some cases, like in Dade County, Florida, and a few other places, that are as high as 10 or 15 of these units called picocuries per gram of calcium, where it should be a half a, or less, as there is in many parts of the country far from nuclear reactors. So we are having a very serious problem, because an increase of about one picocurie in the teeth of children nearly doubles the risk of leukemia and cancer, as we found in Suffolk County, Long Island, when it rose and declined following the rise and decline in strontium 90 in baby teeth.
Hmm. I'd like to ask you three questions, and you can answer them in any order that you wish. First, is it a reality that the radiation exposures to the public from medical x-rays are much larger than the doses produced by the normal operation of nuclear power plants as far as exposure to the people. So explain to us how decades-long rise in cancer incidence and deaths in the United States has been caused by nuclear fission products released from reactors are not in some way also connected to medical x-rays.
That's number one. Number two,
what other adverse effects than those on childhood leukemia and cancer have you found? And three, how much of an increase have we seen in childhood cancer and leukemia in the last, let's say, 30 or 40 years?
Right. Well, let me start with the difference between x-rays and exposure to strontium 90. What was discovered by a Canadian scientist by the name of Dr. Abram Petkow in 1972 and published in Health Physics was that protracted, long-term, chronic irradiation, as we get from the environmental radiation in our food and milk and drinking water that gets into our bones and settles all through the bone and irradiates the bone marrow, is actually produced by a different biological mechanism and is much more dangerous, much more toxic than the same dose given in a short x-ray burst. And that's because free radicals are involved that he found, which are oxygen molecules, which are normal oxygen, but to which an electron became attached because of the penetration of radiation, ionizing radiation, and this went to the cell membranes and punctures them like a balloon. And since it only takes one free radical to puncture a balloon like a needle, you don't have to throw 1,000 needles against the balloon. In fact, it's overkill. And so it turns out that when you have a brief exposure, the free radicals bump into each other, they deactivate each other, and they're inefficient in damaging cells and causing them to die. On the other hand, if you give the same dose over a period of days or weeks or months or even years, then each free radical becomes able to puncture a cell, for instance, in the immune system, and you have a depletion of the immune system that is far greater than anyone had ever expected from any animal and human studies in 100 years since the discovery of x-rays. So we can continue to take x-rays. We're very lucky that we can continue to use diagnostic x-rays. Of course, we don't want to overdo it, and we don't misuse them as they were in the early years of radiology. But today, x-rays are essential and important and are 100 to 1,000 times less toxic than the same dose from environmental radiation. And that's why we have to ultimately end all future nuclear bomb testing, why we must get a Congress that will ratify the treaty to end all bomb testing forever that Kennedy was hoping for, and why we must phase out nuclear plants that release these small amounts of radioactivity that we underestimated in their effect on human health of every type by a factor of 100 to 1,000 times, especially for the newly developing embryo in the mother's womb, when the brain cells are moving around and need to be properly positioned in order for the child to function properly. And so we're getting all kinds of other diseases. Immune system diseases like diabetes has suddenly risen. Asthma has enormously increased again after having declined since the end of bomb testing and suddenly is rising again, and nobody knows why. It's because we made the mistake of believing that because x-rays to an adult were quite relatively harmless, they are devastating to the newly developing embryo and fetus. And that is why, if we have to have radiation, we must only confine it to the laboratory and to the medical uses, but we must end the contamination of our environment by bomb fallout and nuclear accidents like Chernobyl and Three Mile Island and daily releases from nuclear reactors.
Good. Let's go into a few more issues. We only have 5 minutes in this segment. I want to get both of these issues in. If the recently published papers by your research group do in fact strongly suggest that very low levels of nuclear fission products released into the environment are so serious for the health and development of our children, Why is it that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is willing to extend the operating licenses of nuclear plants all over the nation for at least 20 more years without public hearings on recent changes in local health, rather than phasing them out or converting them to natural gas plants at a minimal cost?
Well, that's a good question. I think it has to do with the fact that for decades, the government, the federal government, was mainly concerned about the fact that they had to test nuclear weapons and they had to allay the fears of the public. And that came out under Freedom of Information in the Washington Post back in the early 1979. And it showed that the nuclear plants were actually built by the Eisenhower administration in order to make the public think of the peaceful atom, in order for them not to protest the enormous fallout that has since been documented in government studies that reached both radioactive iodine and strontium 90 and created increased thyroid and other types of cancers all over the nation. And the continued desire of our federal government to rely on nuclear weapons as the only deterrent, it means that the people cannot be told about the serious side effects of even the smallest amount of fallout from bomb testing and the use of a nuclear bomb.
How many people do you think have died because of the effects of fission over the last 45 years?
We think that in the United States alone, judging from the sudden halt in the decline of infant mortality during bomb testing and nuclear reactor operations, and the decline in deaths from all causes by adults, that some 19 million people have died in excess of normal expectations. 19 million people in this country alone. And that includes all kinds of diseases. And it means everything that's related to the immune system, autoimmune diseases, cancers, infectious diseases, the resurgence of certain TBs and other things, because not only, as Sakharov, the Russian scientist, pointed out long ago, not only did the fallout cause a lowering of the immune system among humans, but it also produced mutations and new bugs, like the Ebola virus, the AIDS virus, and many other, like the Lyme disease. All these are new diseases emerging because we have increased the radiation in the natural environment by our nuclear releases from bomb tests in Chernobyl and daily operations of harmless nuclear reactors that are too clean and too cheap to meter.
Well, I appreciate very much, Dr. Sternglass. And do you have an email or web page for people who want more information?
Yes, that's very important, because we really need teeth from all over the country. That gives us a chance to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that it is radiation. And the email can be obtained just by looking in the computer under the website radiation.org. Easy to remember, just radiation.org. And all the instructions are there for sending in baby teeth, and we will measure them, and we will report them by zip code so people know whether in their area there is a high level. And those who want to use a telephone, we have a number, a free number, 1-800-582-3716, that they can call, and they can get all the instructions for mailing in baby teeth. Sometimes more than one, but we want an envelope for each child, and it could be 18, 20 years old. In fact, the older, if grandmothers have baby teeth, we love to have them, because we want to establish the early history more and more, as we have since we started our radiation and health project.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sternglass. Nice to have you on.
Thank you.
Dr. Ernest Sternglass, Professor Emeritus of Nuclear Physics. I'm Gary Knoll. I realize not everyone has an opportunity to listen to the full hour program. So if you can't and you'd like a tape of today's show for this and the next segment on pain, you can call 888-317-2346, 888-317-2346, and ask for program number 2624. We'll be back in a moment after station identification.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. In the center of the maelstrom here at listener-sponsored, commercial-free radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock will be The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille, trying to help you lead a more positively minded life. At 2 p.m., Health Action, Kathy Davis and the Health Action crew from 2 to 3 o'clock. Talk back with you, Treece Lead from 3 to 5. Behind the News at 5 p.m. and the WBAI Evening News at 6 p.m. Back to Natural Living with Gary Null.
I'd like to welcome you, those who have, you are just coming across the dial. I'm Gary Null, and we're talking about health today. We're going to look at one of the most important issues facing at least half the American public on a daily basis, and that is chronic pain. To share an inside look of pain and pain management and natural non-toxic approaches is Dr. Larry Cohen. And Dr. Cohen is a psychiatrist specializing in pain resolution. He is a graduate of the Rusk Institute and the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He was the former director of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Danbury Hospital in Connecticut. And he's board certified in physical medicine and rehabilitation and a diplomat of the American Academy of Pain. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you. I don't know if you said physiatrist or psychiatrist, but I'm not a psychiatrist.
Now, see, you're delusional and psychotic at this moment, which means that you're certainly a psychiatrist, but we'll accept that you're a physiatrist.
Okay.
The four aspects associated with chronic pain are biochemical, electromagnetic, structural, and psycho-emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Each of those have components, and to successfully treat each aspect of pain, one can utilize a number of techniques, including osteopathic or structural diagnosis, trigger point injections, prolotherapy or reconstructive therapy, neural therapy, bee venom therapy, body talk, psychokinesiology, and nutritional, biochemical, and hormone evaluation. So to give a sense of the scope of the epidemic of just one type of pain, such as back pain, I'd like for you to take us through all this. Because, by the way, 85% of all people have back pain once in their lifetime. And
sure.
There are 6.1 million office visits to orthopedic surgeons each year for new onset back pain. And there are over 575,000 hospital admissions for lower back pain. And roughly 2% of the U.S. workforce sustains back injuries at work every year, costing over $11 billion just in treatments for back pain. So let's go through each one of these aspects, the four aspects of pain. Talk about how you see people being able to prevent them and then the natural non-toxic approaches to them, all right?
Sure. Well, you've certainly presented a picture of the scope of the problem. And part of the problem also is who's treating. As you said, most of the people are going to orthopedists as after they see their primary care physician if they're not better, after a work injury or a car accident or just a strain or just gradual onset of a back pain. And the surgeons are basically surgeons. They operate, and that's their tool. And so they're keyed in to looking for surgical lesions. And if you look at most of the literature, less than 3% of back injuries or back pain problems are surgical. And that's really where it's at. And they're not trained to feel muscles or ligaments or tendons. They're trained to treat, you know, X-ray problems or MRI problems of disc herniation or unstable spine or fracture or something like that. So that's part of the problem right off, is that we're sending all our people to the wrong places. Some people end up with chiropractic or osteopathic mobilization. And I think a recent study showed that was very effective. And, again, the biggest majority of people will heal on their own. Something like 75% of back injuries will get better with time, whether you do ice, whether you do heat, whether you do rest, whether you do activity. That's, again, the beauty of our system. Our body is made to heal itself. One of the sad factors of current medicine, and I have to admit, I was trained in classical medical school and came in and started, you know, prescribing all these medications, and I've since pulled dramatically back and hardly use medications much at all. But part of the problem is, look at the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. That's a fancy name for aspirin and all its derivatives. People have been taking these since they were developed. I think Bayer first started out with aspirin, and then there's been a hundred others from Nuprin and Advil and Motrin and, you know, tons of them. Lodine, Daypro, goes on and on and on. And the fact of the matter is, these work partially as painkillers and partially turning off inflammation. And they see inflammation as a painful irritant. That's the enemy. And the fact of the matter is, inflammation is this exquisitely, beautifully developed technique that our body has for healing itself. And when you study the inflammatory process in medical school, it's a wonder. And here we are, we're interfering with it, we're stopping it at the beginning because it's a little bit uncomfortable. But in fact, it's necessary to heal. So when you have a car accident and you get strained ligaments and torn muscles, there's a benefit to blocking the pain if it gets you moving sooner, because that will help you heal. But the downside, you could do that just as easily with a good painkiller, but without the anti-inflammatory effects. When you start cutting off inflammation, you're cutting off your chance for a strained ligament to heal optimally. And that's one of the spots where people get into trouble.
Well, explain, most people are taught to turn off all symptoms of any condition. They're to turn off a fever, they're to turn off any local sensation, swelling. Now explain what actually is happening in the body that the body may need to go through this process for
right.
healing. And if we interfere in its natural healing process, we are structurally not getting to the underlying cause.
And we're setting ourselves up for later injury because we have incomplete healing. Now, there are, I don't want to totally be black and white. There are cases where the body turns against itself and inflammation goes wild. And those are called autoimmune diseases. Rheumatoid arthritis is one of them. Lupus is one of them. And in these cases, suppressing inflammation, or actually there are natural ways of approaching it too, but I certainly won't fault people on that way. But on most injuries, when we cut off the inflammation, we're getting incomplete healing. And you have ligaments and tendons that don't have the best blood supply to start off with. Muscles will heal no matter what you do, for the most part. They have so much blood going through them, they're going to respond. They have all the elements of inflammation that you need there to heal them. But what inflammation does is if there's a cut or a wound and there's dirt in there, it'll come in and it'll identify them and gobble them up and get rid of the dirt, get rid of the germs. Your immune system gets kicked in and protects you from the outside environment. You know, there's all this fuss about wiping the skin before you give an injection, and yet, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people with diabetes inject their skin all the time. We constantly have little fissures and cracks in dry skin and little breaks where outside invaders get in, and we don't get infections and lose our fingers and all these other things because we have a somewhat competent immune system which can handle all these things. But certainly the immune system is a big piece of kicking in and getting ourselves on the healing track. We also start laying down reparative collagen. We start build. If there's an injury to a ligament or a tendon or a muscle, we start repairing it. If it's a torn fiber or a tear away of a piece of ligament as it attaches to the bone and the little piece of bone pulls away, that starts healing. The bone ligament attachment gets thicker and stronger. It's an interesting fact that when a kid breaks his leg and it heals, unless it's a terrible, terrible break with misalignment, in most cases, in most normal cases of a broken arm or a broken leg, the healed bone is stronger than the surrounding bone. Because when we heal ourselves, we get stronger. And that's one of the experimental findings of prolotherapy research.
Explain why that's the case. Most people would say, well, wouldn't I be stronger before I broke it? And wouldn't I be weaker after?
Well, when you make a heel, you know, it's the same thing. I'm a woodworker, and it's a fascinating thing. But if you join two pieces of wood with the right glue and you do it well, if you try and rip them apart, the wood will rip apart somewhere else, not at the glue joint. That's how strong the glue is. And the body works very similarly. When you make a repair, it overcompensates, if you will, and makes it super strong. And what they found with the ligaments when they do prolotherapy, and I'll explain what prolotherapy is, but they found that instead of getting 100% of strength, you end up with something like 140%. They did these tests on rabbits where they injected the tendons on one side of the body with prolotherapy and the other side just with, you know, water or control. And they found that the ligament strength on the prolotherapy side increased 140%. And, I mean, I'm just waiting for the football players to figure this one out and start going for, you know, they're not allowed to dope themselves with drugs, but boy.
Well, should we all go out and, you know, break someone's bones and then say that you're going to have a stronger bone, so you should pay me for breaking your bones?
Sort of.
They'd like that in some cities.
So prolotherapy, which this leads us into, is the next topic, is a treatment for ligament or tendon irritation and or strain or torn fibers that didn't heal and that are a source of irritation and pain. And we actually injure them. We go in with a needle and jab them a few times, cause some bleeding, which also starts inflammation. We inject a dense sugar solution, dextrose, and that sucks the water out of the cells next to it and causes a little injury as well. And sometimes we add an irritating fish oil called moruate, which is from cod liver oil, and it's also one of the main mediators of inflammation in the body. And so we do all these things to create a controlled injury just where the ligament is irritated and where it attaches to bone, and then the body comes in the next few weeks, 6 to 8 weeks perhaps, and heals it and makes it stronger. And sometimes one treatment is all you need. Sometimes if a person has very loose ligaments, some of these people who can put their knees behind their heads and, you know, go into all these yoga contortions, so flexible, they're great for flexibility, but if they get into a car accident, they're in bad shape because their ligaments are already kind of loose. So we have to tighten them, takes more treatments. But it's a marvelous treatment for getting rid of pain that's coming from these irritated areas. Is that clear?
Yeah, that's very clear. Let's go through the other therapies now.
Okay, well, let's talk. Let me bring it to the next piece. Are you familiar with myofascial pain and trigger points?
Yeah, any of the topics.
Yeah, well,
I want to go through all of them.
Okay.
And we don't have a whole lot of time. You only have about 12 minutes, so I want you to get right into them.
Well, I'll jump in. Trigger points are irritable bands in muscle. And they're the main mediators of pain. When you have a pain, things get blamed on x-ray findings all the time. I had a person in my office today who had seen his podiatrist for heel pain, and the podiatrist did an x-ray and said, oh, you have a heel spur, and did a steroid injection, which I'm terribly against. And lo and behold, the guy's pain wasn't any different. And I found that he had muscle triggers in his calf, and that refers pain down to the heel. And I injected them, and the heel pain was gone. And very often, pain is referred, which means it comes at a site different from where the actual irritant is. And it comes from muscle triggers. Now, muscle triggers can be pure muscle triggers, that there's nothing, you overloaded a muscle and you set up a trigger point, and then you go in with a little needle and you put a little Novocaine in perhaps, and you just get the trigger point to release and you twitches, it's very visible, very easy to see, and the pain is gone and the muscle is fine and you're all better. There are more complex issues where, like say you strain a ligament or a tendon, then the muscle that's attached or the muscle that goes over that joint will be irritated and be triggered. And there you could inject the trigger, but unless you find that irritated ligament or joint and do prolotherapy there, that muscle trigger will not go away. So muscle triggers are another mediator of pain. Another and one of the most powerful tools that I use is called neural therapy, which is the basis of acupuncture. It's a Western way of understanding a lot of therapies, massage therapy, magnetic therapy. It's understanding the workings of the what's called the autonomic nervous system, which communicates our entire body. It's got all, it runs with every blood vessel. There are nerves that control whether the blood vessels are open or tight. whether they allow a lot of blood flow or restrict it. In acupuncture terms, you'd think of flow of qi or energy and whether the qi is flowing or not. And it's similar. It's all stemming from control of the autonomic nervous system. And, in fact, the bladder meridian and kidney meridians in acupuncture are right over the sympathetic trunk of the sympathetic nervous system. So as you understand that and you learn to manipulate these nerves, you find that you can have incredibly powerful effects. One of the most powerful pieces is scars, surgical scars that, you know, patients get from gallbladder, appendix, a hernia, back surgery, neck surgery, all these different bunion surgery. They can be so potent irritants in the nervous system, and they can cause irritation elsewhere. I had a patient yesterday who came to see me for his knee, had terrible knee pain and restriction. He couldn't bend it all the way, and it hurt all the time. And I didn't find anything wrong with his knee, per se, but he'd had a gallbladder surgery with a giant scar across his abdomen on the same side, and that tested out as being an irritant. And I said, let's try. I didn't tell him what to expect, that it was going to affect the knee, but I thought it might. And I injected the entire gallbladder scar, and he got up, and I said, how's the knee feel? And I touched it, and it wasn't tender anymore where it was tender before. And he bent it, and he could bend it the whole way. You should have seen him. He was bending it like 20 times. He couldn't believe it. He was showing his wife and saying, this is incredible. And the pain was gone at the knee, and it was all coming from the gallbladder scar. So people can't appreciate this. I mean, it sounds almost fanciful. I sometimes step back in wonder and amazement at how fantastic it is and the effects. I have had other patients who have had tremendous head-to-toe pain, and by injecting their scars, the pain's gone. It's just so dramatic. And that's a piece of neural therapy. Obviously, in 12 minutes, we can't go into everything. Another piece, which you talked about, is the nutritional, the hormonal. These can all have influence on your state of irritability. The muscle triggers are more irritable if you're depleted in vitamins, especially the B vitamins. If your hormones are off, if you're low testosterone, low growth hormone, if your thyroid is off, you can be irritable muscles, more likely to have muscle triggers. So all of these things can play roles in a pain cycle that a person is experiencing. And a big part of it is getting to the right person who can figure out what the issues are, who knows how to examine and feel muscles, ligaments, tendons. Most people, most of the clinicians out there don't know these things and don't examine them. It's amazing. Some of the patients cry when I examine them. They say no one ever found the spot that hurts. And again, a good, careful, you know, I spend an hour and a half looking at them, and it shows. So what other topic? You want to talk about the psycho-emotional?
Well, I'd like to go through a few others that people don't hear at all about. One would be trigger point therapy, and also I'd like to go through bee venom.
Well, that's very topical. The bee venom is very powerful. There are studies going right now on MS, and I've been using it more and more now with recalcitrant cases of Lyme disease. There was a wonderful article that showed that the main ingredient of bee venom, which is called melatonin, paralyzes the Lyme disease spirochete. And that may be one of the reasons that some people really, really respond so powerfully to it. I have one patient who I think has Lyme underlying his joint problems, and I did bee venom injections around his fingers and hands, and it all disappeared. He had hurt and itched like, you know what, for a day or two, but that pain is gone. And now I did it to his neck, and I got to see how he's doing there, and hopefully we'll get him pain-free with it. And the bee venom has potent proteins in it that are anti-inflammatory. Some are more powerful than cortisol. It has, again, the melatonin. It has, it's just a very active with arthritis, with, I don't know if you ever heard of shingles, post-herpetic neuralgia, people who have this terrible burning pain from this virus, and it's terrible, and there's very little things that cure it, but I found that 50 or 60% of the people will respond to bee venom injections.
Okay, let's also talk about body talk.
Okay.
Oh, we haven't done that. Well, and psychokinesiology.
Well, these are two techniques that I use. There are other techniques out there. There's neuroemotional technique, or NET, which is a chiropractic technique. These are techniques, and there's also EMDR, which is a psychological technique using eye movements. And they're all very similar in a lot of ways. They try and access the underlying psycho-emotional issues behind most disease states or pain problems or allergies, because the fact is you usually can find an underlying psycho-emotional factor that may be in part perpetuating or causing us to be sick. You know, two different people can have the same exact injury from a fall or a car accident. One gets better and one doesn't. And why is that? In some people it might be because their nutrition is off. In other people it might have an infection in their teeth that's smoldering that just winds up that pain, or a scar from a surgery. But in other people they can have emotional scars from their childhood or from their more formative years that can perpetuate pain problems. One of my most challenging cases was a woman who had slipped in a supermarket and had a neck injury. And the neck pain, I could get it to go away a little bit, but it would always come back. And finally, I started exploring the psycho-emotional side of things. And what I came to find out was that she had been terribly abused by her stepfather. She felt that her mother hated her, and that she was unlovable. And if you deep, deep down inside at the level of the belief system, core beliefs, believe that you're bad and should be punished because your mom doesn't like you, you know, and these are core beliefs, there's nothing that I'm going to do that's going to get you better until we deal with that issue. Because you won't let yourself get better. You feel you need to be punished. So these are just a couple of techniques that try and use the eye movements, they use color, they use muscle testing to try and ask the body or the subconscious yes or no questions and try and find out what the issue is and where it's stored and try and uncouple it so that the person has the chance and the opportunity to move beyond it and heal. Because these are very, very potent. They're the underpinnings of a lot of our diseases. You know, this is a lot of reason why our body gets ill. Because we do it to ourselves.
Okay, we only have about 4 minutes. Why don't we summarize what we've learned about the different treatments, natural, non-toxic treatments for pain, and how a person goes about finding which would work best for them?
Well, that's a good question. There are non-toxic treatments. In fact, the more I learn, the less I'm leaning towards the use of the medications that are the classic armamentarium for pain. And you can start by looking for someone who is trained in body work, like an osteopath or a good, well-skilled chiropractor. You can look for you can contact the American Association of Orthopedic Medicine, which focuses on prolotherapy. Some of them do bee venom and neural therapy as well. And if you find someone with those skills, there's a good chance that they'll be looking more closely and at more things than another practitioner might. They have a better sense and focus on looking at the muscles, the ligaments, the joints, looking at the nervous system, looking at psychological issues, and trying to get a unified program that addresses all the issues that are key. Every person is a puzzle. Every person, you know, I don't always get a home run the first time I try an injection. Sometimes it's a struggle. It's finding out what's perpetuating what. I've seen people with car accidents where they have neck pain, and it's only neck pain, and people have been doing MRIs of the neck, and they've been injecting the neck forever, and what they haven't realized is that when they jammed on the brake, they displaced the cuboid bone in the foot. And it doesn't hurt unless I press on it as compared to the other foot, but they're not aware of it hurting, but their body senses it and so compensates. And it shifts the way the pelvis is, and that shifts the way the neck is, and it ends up in being neck pain. But you can inject the neck forever if you don't know to look at the foot and check for that, you're never going to figure out what the person's problem is, and you're never going to get rid of their pain. Most pain management people manage pain. They give narcotics, they do nerve blocks, and that's all. I really try and find out what's causing it and get rid of it. And that is the focus of orthopedic medicine and neurotherapy.
Hmm. So I think let's just summarize now and see where we're at.
Yeah.
You've given us understandings of the therapeutic benefit of several modalities, including osteopathic or structural diagnosis. It's a small pebble in your shoe may over time produce back and neck pain. This occurs as your body shifts your posture, as you just mentioned, in gait to ease the pressure of your foot. And similarly, structural dysfunction of the feet, the limbs, the pelvis, and spine can produce pain locally or at a distance. Trigger point injections, a trigger point is a knot in a muscle, which frequently refers pain to a nearby site in the body. Triggers hurt when the muscle containing them is stretched or shortened, so movement is often restricted. And if trigger points do not resolve with appropriate physical therapy, then trigger point injections are performed to mechanically break up or release the triggers. Prolotherapy is a treatment for tendon and ligament sprain or laxity, and by injecting a substance designed to induce inflammation, the body's healing cascade is stimulated to produce stronger and tighter attachments of tendon and ligament to the bone. And this has special significance for people with osteoarthritis and whiplash or low back strains, where clinical research has demonstrated 85% success in providing relief. Neurotherapy uses local anesthetic nerve blocks to restore normal functioning to the autonomic nervous system, and the autonomic nervous system communicates with and regulates all parts of the body, so stresses from surgery, infection, or other physical or emotional trauma can produce irritation of the autonomic nervous locally. And this limits the blood supply to those local tissues and thus leads to pain and illness. And most of the sensory autonomic nerve fibers in the body course through the skin, making it a potent area for treatment. And then you have bee venom therapy, used in the Middle East and in China for 12 centuries. And it's used to treat all types of arthritis, musculoskeletal, multiple sclerosis. Works locally at the injection site as well as systemically. Primarily through melatonin, which stimulates the immune system, and apamin, which increases pain tolerance. And then you have psychokinesiology, neuro and biochemical. And that's it. And I want to thank you, Dr. Larry Cohen, for being on and sharing your insights.
My pleasure.
People want more information, they can just reach you in New York, right?
Actually, I'm in Danbury, Connecticut, Advanced Pain Care in Danbury, Connecticut.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Larry Cohen. And if you'd like a tape of today's show, call 888-317-2346, program number 2624. Have a nice day, everyone. We'll see you tomorrow.